listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 32nd installment of our conversation ongoing with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR. And I think we're going to go back to talking about Trotsky. He got about 5 minutes of our conversation last week, and he's due at least another 10, right?
Yes. Hello. I'm glad to be with you again. It's a pleasure.
Yes, my pleasure.
And we did shortchange poor Trotsky last time. Okay. So we'll go back. But first, I need to frame the discussion for today, which is about fascism in the 30s.
Right.
So, framework. We live again in an age of Western imperialism,
mm-hmm.
led by the United States.
Mm.
Now, imperialism, Lenin said, was the last stage of capitalism. We don't mean by that the end of capitalism. We know that the beast has 7 lives.
At least.
But at any rate, that it can renew itself. But
the highest stage. The highest stage, like the
highest, that's right.
In terms of evolution, the highest evolutionary stage.
The highest, that's right.
Because
that's
what it does, it's a globalization of the whatever becomes the dominant capitalist structure. It brings it to a planetary scale or to a semi-planetary scale, so it coexists with another one or two. But that's where we are now.
Yeah, that's the key. And what he meant was that unless capitalism, a certain place, moved beyond its national boundaries, it could not renew itself. It could not it would die. So in a way, the imperialist surge is a kind of capitalism on life support. That's why I probably substituted last for highest, because it could be that.
Well, right.
So in a way, an imperialist surge is, as I said, on life support. Now, this support comes from the infusion of blood by theft and rapine, by loot and exploitation of lands that belong to other peoples.
Right.
Now, in the early 20th century, Britain was in this situation, and it struggled to maintain primacy over other imperialist competitors, so a piece of the globe led to World War I. Now, this war bled Britain. The empire could not be sustained. The colonies rose up, and Britain ended up selling its imperial assets, things like British petroleum in the 50s, to the United States in exchange for a junior partnership. Now it's America's turn to go for broke.
Right.
It's imperialism or bust. It's also a bipartisan imperative, but the Dems, the Democrats, the liberal establishment, I would venture to say, are the most focalized in this. If you look at the record, we had Bush and he did Iraq and Afghanistan. We had Clinton and we had Obama, and count the wars and the aggressions that went on with them. Yugoslavia first. And then under Obama, we have what?
Well, let's see. We had several coups, a number of them actually going back to Clinton also. But we had the coups in Paraguay and Honduras. We had the, really, if you want to...
And in Ukraine.
Yeah, Ukraine, and also, to be realistic, in Brazil, which was really directly a coup. In Guatemala, really, you had an uprising, and that was co-opted. That was essentially a coup also.
Yeah.
That's the overt, right? And that's the overt stuff. And then you had the destruction of Libya, junior partnership with France in the recolonization of North Africa, moving towards Central Africa. Everything that's going on the east coast of Africa to try to thwart relations between Africa and, One Road, One Belt that's developing, the String of Pearls and all of that. There's a lot of activity. Bush was actually kind of clumsy in his administration of empire, although he did help to institute much of the architecture that was used by Obama subsequently, and it still exists and is in use.
Yeah, and the legal architecture with the Patriot Act. That then amplified,
etc.
Actually, Clinton began the a challenge to the United Nations and its monopoly on a peace and war. I mean, that's what Kosovo did.
That's right.
The phony legalism of the responsibility to protect.
That's right.
That castrated the Security Council.
That's right, which ended up coming back to haunt them. I mean, that's the same thing that was invoked in Libya, and once they showed the world in Libya what it really was. China and Russia said no more and started vetoing.
Yeah.
Like they tried to go right to Syria,
that's right.
And that's where we are now too. That's been thwarted.
Yeah. So now we see that in this stage of imperialism right now, there is a strange phenomenon attached to it, fascism, the word fascism, the effect fascism. Anyway, this word, this thing is around. Now, throughout the imperialist West, we see that liberal democracy seems to be twinned with anti-democratic formations. I don't know if I need to add anything to that because, no, just let's leave it simply like that.
Yeah, let that stand as it is for the moment. Yeah, let it stand.
Yeah. Now, to understand why this strange coexistence of imperialism and fascism, or a fascist effect, in whatever key, low or high, to understand how this imperialism and fascism crop up together, we must go back to the 1930s. And of course, there is one glaring difference between today and yesterday. There is no socialist or communist presence in the West. So let's put this aside for the moment and look at two opposing views towards fascism, Stalin and Trotsky. It's very interesting, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Stalin said, it is not true that fascism is only the fighting organization of the bourgeoisie. Fascism is not only a military technical category. Fascism is the bourgeoisie's fighting organization that relies on the active support of social democracy. So it's not a force that spontaneously... Is that clear?
Yeah, let me make it.
Your words?
Yeah, let's use some contemporary language, because these terms have those that would support, for example, what they would call a progressive agenda. Let's back up before the last couple of years, because everything's gotten even more befuddling. But let's say, you know, someone that was bringing about, like, a, you know, getting behind a program like, say, Denis Kucinich inside the Democratic Party. Not Denis himself personally, but that kind of politics.
Yeah.
And so that's your progressive, you know, your social democratic force inside the country. And they're calling for things like, you know, shorter work week, full employment. I mean, things that aren't even mentioned here. health care for all, free education, housing, you know, with dignity and, you know, not just affordable, but housing for everyone. You see, so you have that program and you have people that are working on it, bills that are being proposed in the Congress and that are getting passed at the state level, and an actual apparatus of social democracy, or of a progressive movement in the body politic. At the same time, when someone comes along and says, we're with that program, and the way we fund it is by taking what's our due from the rest of the world, that's what you're marrying together. You're marrying together American foreign policy, say, with Swedish domestic policy, or imperialism with social democracy.
Yeah. That's right. That's good. Yeah. So this distinction that Stalin makes between it's not the fighting organization of the bourgeoisie, hold on, I will finish. Sorry, I will finish the definition, because I think this is so crucial. Fascism is the bourgeoisie's... Fascism is the bourgeoisie's fighting organization that relies on the active support of social democracy. Social democracy is objectively the moderate wing of fascism. This is explosive.
Right. That's right.
Objectively, the moderate wing of fascism.
Right.
There is no ground for assuming that the fighting organization of the bourgeoisie can achieve decisive success in battles or in governing the country without the active support of social democracy. This is the bomb.
Right.
He says that fascism, a fascist formation, paramilitary and political, cannot help without the support of social democracy. Now, here's Trotsky. Trotsky says, it is not true that social democracy and fascism are twins. Now, of course, being Trotsky, he's going to make a muddle by 1938. He's just going to sound crazy. But anyway, in 1932, he says it's not true. So what does he recommend? 1932, right? He says, worker communist, you are a hundred of thousands, millions. You cannot leave for any place. There are not enough passports for you. Should fascism come to power, it will ride over your skulls and spines like a terrific tank. Your salvation lies in merciless struggle. And only a fighting unity with the social democratic workers can bring victory.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Make haste, worker communist. You have very little time left, yeah?
Yeah, sounds familiar, doesn't it? I mean, look, first of all, we know what actually happened.
Yes.
In Germany.
Go ahead.
Well, you had many of the workers who were formerly parts of communist and or socialist party formations, certainly social democracy, because you started having the shifting definition of that taking place in Germany and elsewhere in Europe from meaning Marxist to non-Marxist collaborationist over the issue of World War I and a number of other things. But what you had happen is as the social democracy was used as a net to bring the workers into fascism, and then once in there, they destroyed, they decapitated it. The Night of the Long Knives. That's what that whole purge was, where they purged the working class character of fascism out of the fascist party.
Yeah, so Stalin says, it's not a good idea to unite, to form an alliance with social democracy, because they'll end up, they'll end up facilitating fascism.
That's right.
And Trotsky says, in order to prevent, this is, the Hitler period. We're talking about 1932.
That's correct.
Here.
Yeah. No, I understand.
Yeah. So, what happened?
Right.
The social democrats elected Hindenburg.
Right.
A kind of reactionary general, because they thought that way they could prevent the Nazis from coming to power. And,
right.
And what did Hindenburg do?
He appointed Hitler chancellor and then surrendered the powers of the state to the chancellery.
So who is right?
Right. That's right.
According to Trotsky, the social democrats and the communists should have united. Well, what do you think the social democrats would have done once they had arrested victory from Hitler? Turn on their communists.
That's right. Which is exactly what happened.
So what?
That's exactly what happened. Even inside their own party.
Yeah, that's right. As you pointed out. So, of course, he was writing this unity appeal, interestingly, in 1932, when the Comintern, the Fifth Comintern, was still in effect. The Comintern that said, "Do not make a lie," and capitalism is weak. The revolution is on the horizon. Therefore, intensify the class struggle. Do not make alliances with bourgeois parties. So Trotsky is actually addressing that situation. No. The opposite of that. No. Unite and fight together.
Right.
That will completely reverse when the next Comintern comes in, the Popular Front. So.
Right.
So he wrote this in 1932, when the policy of the Comintern was still that of class struggle, of a conflict relationship with all bourgeois parties, including the Social Democrats. He wrote it blaming Stalin for fascism by ignoring the threat of its rise to power.
Right.
I mean, so looking at Germany and Hitler, was Trotsky right? Well, we went through that.
Yeah.
Now...
Well, see, let me just again off to the side for a second, because we're seeing something here that we also saw in Barcelona, for example, where you know, Trotsky and that whole group, as they blame Stalin for Hitler, they base that on an alleged betrayal of, you know, of the communists inside Germany and elsewhere, of the international struggle, that they didn't emphasize it, that they abandoned it, that they made league with the fascists to let the working class party in Germany stand alone, blah, 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 blah. And this is the same thing that they were talking about inside of Spain at the time. And it was also not true. What Trotsky is doing and what he does, this is one of the things that it occurred to me looking back at the history of this over the course of these talks. One of the things that he does is advocate for unity of the class when the bourgeois elements are in power or in control of the unifying structure, and argues against unity when it's the working class that's in control of it. In other words, it's fine to have a unified working class behind some fascists because there are workers there, or social democrats. So behind Hindenburg, for example, that's fine. If the entire working class lines up behind, say, Stalin, for example, that's not fine. Mm-hmm. That's dangerous, bad adventurism, and who knows what else. So the actual issue is the class character of the leadership of this unity. When you have unified class and its bourgeois leadership, no problem. When you have unified class and its proletarian leadership, dangerous, bad, etc.
It's amazing. And I can illustrate that with a 1938 interview, support what you just said. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. So he was interviewed in Mexico, and he claimed, in this 1938, he said that fascism was the mechanism that would trigger proletariat revolution. To illustrate, here's what he says in an interview in Mexico in 1938. He says, "In Brazil, there now reigns a semi-fascist regime. If England enters into a military conflict with Brazil, whose side of the conflict will the working class be? In this case, I will be on the side of fascist Brazil against democratic Great Britain. Because if England should be victorious, she will put another fascist in Rio de Janeiro."
Right.
"And will place double chains on Brazil. If Brazil, on the contrary, should be victorious," this is fascist Brazil,
right,
"it will give a mighty impulse to national and democratic consciousness of the country and will lead to the overthrow of the Vargas dictatorship." Right. Tell me where that happened.
Right, and then the defeat of England will at the same time deliver a blow to British imperialism. In other words, this is an argument that actually Trotskyists argue against today. That you have people that identify as Trotskyists and that are otherwise identifiable as Trotskyists today will talk about not defending the Syrian government against imperialism because, you know, both the nascent Russian imperialism is defending Syria and Syria's dictator is a dictator. In other words, Trotsky argues back in 1938, ally with the anti-imperialist forces, no matter what, even if they're fascist, because what you're doing is helping to take down the imperialist powers. Here, the opposite is what's argued. Do not stand with Russia. Do not stand with China, which, by the way, is a communist country without any question, et cetera, et cetera. It's an interesting contradiction. And you have to look at the historical context to really understand it. So, go ahead. You were about to explain what's up in the 30s and what this means.
Yeah. But, of course, they are against the... they're against the Chinese because... the Chinese communism is a bureaucracy.
Oh, well.
You forget.
Right. Fascism, okay. Bureaucracy, no. Okay.
No, it's really, I'm sorry. I'm being iconoclastic.
But it's true, though, too. I mean, it's that absurd.
Yeah. So where were we going then?
So I was going to say, let's contextualize in 1938 why it is that he's advocating fighting against imperialism more than fascism. What's the particular historical character? And I would say that it is the same fight that was going on in terms of assembling alliances in Europe. For example, does the United States ally with Germany or with the Bolsheviks? That was the discussion going on here. Same in Great Britain, by the way. People like Churchill were not so inclined to help defend the Soviet Union. And in fact, the U.S. and Britain waited until a maximum destruction had been visited upon the Soviet Union because they saw that as a greater threat. Again, the class character of it is the determining factor. The Soviet Union is a working class state. Forget all the rest of the nonsense that Trotsky and his other people put on it. No doubt that it's a working class state. Britain, U.S., bourgeoisie, and big overlap there. So Germany, German fascism, Italian fascism, first of all, they're also bourgeois states, and also there's a good deal of overlap, a lot of business going on, say, with Ford Motor Company and others across the borders between the UK and US and Germany. But even the worst the German bourgeoisie is a rival bourgeoisie as opposed to, you know, an existential threat to the system.
Yeah. So I don't know whether we should go, whether I should continue to expose Trotsky's increasing incoherence and lunacy, especially in 1938, or examine that in contemporary terms, that thesis that social democracy.
You know what? We've got about 4.5 minutes left. So why don't we just finish up talking about Trotsky in that period, and then we'll pick up.
We have Trump and we have the whole establishment, the whole liberal establishment against him, and we have Trump being called a fascist when, according to Stalin's definition, it's the social democracy that's the enabler of imperialism. And people don't see it, but we can...
Not just the enabler of it. They've been operating the levers of it. I mean, you know, not for nothing. The Republican and Democratic parties have been the parties of imperialism. And the opposition among the political establishment in the United States comes from the deep parts of the Democratic and Republican parties, among other places. So, you know, the actual Democratic and Republican parties are adversaries of Trump's. They're opponents of Trump's. And so whatever Trump is, imperialism is against him.
I call it the Trump effect. It's easier to that way. You don't get into personality.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, I'll just end up with a bit of dirt. Trotsky says that in he says. By 1938, he's really very, very bitter. He says that the Soviet Union, meaning Stalin, would eventually side with Britain to curry favor among the European democracies. And this is another myth that surfaces among the Trotskyists, you know, that he was... and they personalize the figure of Stalin and say that he was just this... the servant of the West.
Right.
So he says, Trotsky says, in all Latin American countries, the problems of the agrarian revolution are indissolubly connected with anti-imperialist struggle. True. The Stalinists are now treacherously paralyzing both one and the other. False. To the Kremlin, the Latin American countries are just small change in its dealings with imperialists. I don't know. How does he know? Any evidence?
No.
Stalin says to Washington, London, and Paris, recognize me as an equal partner, and I will help you put down the revolutionary movements in the colonies and semi-colonies. For this, I have in my service hundreds of agents. Stalinism has become the leprosy of the liberating movement. So Stalinism is an agent of the West.
Right.
in 1938, Trotsky says.
Right.
And puts down anti-colonial struggle.
So
he's an agent of imperialism.
Right.
Now, this is the man, Stalin, who in 1913 wrote a seminal text on nationalities, arguing for equality for the people who were the subject of the Tsar's empire. In 1917, these peoples of the Tsar's prison were granted equality and including the right to secede. This is the Stalin who will help North Korea and China to repel Western imperialism occupation and will send food, arms, and advisors when Russia was short of it. So, you
right.
know.
That's right. You know, and the funny part, I mean, the way it actually plays out in history, you know, he's talking in 1938. What happens in 1941? You know, what happens in 1945? What happens in the period after 1945? Who's on which side? I mean, we don't see the kind of betrayal that Trotsky's talking about until at least Khrushchev. And even then, it had to be very guided because the people themselves wouldn't have tolerated it if they recognized what was happening. So
that's right.
Stalin, that's the environment Stalin left behind. And that is exactly the environment, by the way, that Trotsky found intolerable.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
but that's not all. Stalinism is also fascism.
I know. That's part of the popular culture now, and also the very idea that, for example, they accuse both Russia and China of conspiring with the U.S. and the EU to suppress anti-colonial movements because they're waiting to step up to be the next imperial power. We have to stop here because we're out of time. Luciana, we'll pick this up next week, and I think we've got a good jump-off point to bring it into the contemporary period.
Excellent. I'm very pleased.
Me too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Maria Zakharova is the spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry. She held her weekly press conference on Wednesday, and we bring that to you in its entirety here.
As tradition goes, allow me to begin the briefing with the agenda of the foreign minister of the Russian Federation, Sergei Lavrov. On the 16th of March, in the capital of the Republic of Kazakhstan, the ministers of foreign affairs of three countries, Russia, Iran, and Turkey, will have a meeting to discuss the matters of coordinating the efforts of the guarantors of the Astana process on promoting the settlement in Syria. The format of the event will be different from the classical international formula in Astana because they do not invite the representatives of the Syrian government or the opposition or external observers, with the exception of the special representative of the UN General Secretary on Syria, Mr. De Mistura. And, of course, we leave this matter on the consideration of Kazakhstan, but the participants are supposed to be accepted by the President of Kazakhstan, and the ministerial meeting will be preceded by a session of the joint work group and the first session of the work group on the liberation of detained hostages, a transfer of bodies of the deceased, and a search for those missing in action. And if we get any additional information or corrections on the agenda of the minister, we will inform you later. And now let us move on to our main agenda on international relations and politics of the Russian Federation and the current international issues. I would like to begin with the recently traditional topic and talk to you about the preparations for the upcoming presidential elections in Russia abroad. In the zone of responsibility concerning the work of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and its foreign missions. Due to the upcoming presidential elections in Russia, which, as you all know, will take place on the 18th of March, we would like to draw the attention of the journalists and our citizens going abroad and who will be staying abroad during the vote. Yes, who will be there in the days of the vote, rather, because it will take place not only on the 18th of March. A number of citizens have an opportunity to vote beforehand if they are abroad. We've told you about that. And the website of the Central Election Committee of the Russian Federation has instructions on how to take part in the vote in case you are abroad and you are a Russian citizen. And I would like to take note of the information on the vote abroad. The official website of the Russian Foreign Ministry has published instructions on voting for Russian citizens who are permanent residents or temporary being outside of Russian Federation, who live on private invitations, on business or tourist trips, and Russians who are going as guests or tourists, as well as Russian citizens who are planning to be in transit or on their way on the days of the vote. You can find the list of the polling stations outside of the territory of the Russian Federation, as well as their contact information, including the addresses and phone numbers, the hotlines. Everything has been verified and checked. This was a very thorough work involving all our foreign missions. The information has been verified, and if that is not enough, if you have any more questions, we are always ready to answer them in a timely manner. We call on all the voters who will be staying abroad in these days to take due note of this information. We always draw your attention to this, because unfortunately, social networks, for some reason, perhaps maliciously or not, spread the information saying that if a person is on a short trip abroad, they will have no opportunity due to the red tape to take part in the vote. They say that they have to go to the consular register, they have to apply a whole number of documents. Another myth is that in order to get all the required paperwork to work, they will spend up to 3 months. This is all not true. Everything is being done in order to allow them to vote. We don't talk about any weeks or months. All the detailed instructions on how to vote abroad are published on the official website on the Russian Foreign Ministry and our foreign missions in relevant countries and the website of the Central Election Commission. I have, for example, seen a post on social networks. A man was promoting for one of the candidates and said that he would vote for them, but on that day they would be in one of the European countries, and so unfortunately, keeping in mind that the paperwork would require, according to some information, up to several weeks, I won't be able to do that. No, you will. Everything can be done in a timely and quick manner. You only need to have the passport of the Russian citizen. I say once again, the step-by-step instructions are published on our websites. On the 18th of March, our country will celebrate an important event, the 4th anniversary of the reunification of Russia with Crimea. Yes, excuse me. Of course, life has confirmed that the decision made by the people of Crimea during the Crimean referendum in 2014 was right. And it was the only way to protect the interests of the population of Crimea and to protect them from the radicalism in Ukraine, from those who came to power after a coup d'etat, which is being hidden nowadays. Today, the Republic of Crimea and the federal city of Sebastopol are integrated into the Russian political, legal, and economic space. And we would like to emphasize the illusory of the Western expectations that this reality would change through pressure against Russia. The politicized nature of the information campaign confirms the estimations of more than 100 foreign delegations who visited the peninsula in 2017. And once again, I say that the estimations and evaluations of the situation in Crimea, political, economical, as well as the human rights situation provided through international structures, are given by those who have never been to Crimea. And in spite of that, they use these unverified data and indirect sources in order to publish reports, which unfortunately become the basis for taking relevant decisions and declarations, including official ones. And we say once again, and we will keep saying, that you are welcome to visit Crimea. We are not trying to smoothen the edges. We are not trying to embellish the life of Crimea today. We want an objective evaluation. In particular, by those who actually know the life of Crimea today. I mean the foreign delegations and foreign representatives. They all say that the situation is stable, and they notice obvious social and economic results and success and progress, although much is yet to be done. Today, Crimea has 14 regional national cultural autonomies, including two Crimean Tatar autonomies. Crimea has a program of social and economic development and the program for Crimea and Sevastopol to 2020 on the sum of 700 billion rubles. And there is growing interest in cooperation with Crimea from foreign business and public circles. And the confirmation of this trend was the founding of the International Association of Friends of Crimea. The life in Crimea is very rich, and 2018 Crimea will have more than 400 public events, including official and religious holidays and anniversaries for the people living in the peninsula. In January 2018, Crimea was visited by more than 120,000 tourists. And this year, a road will open on the Kerch Bridge, Republic of Crimea and the city of Sevastopol. It is my opinion that they should be the ones talking about this, but keeping in mind that I talk with the journalists who represent foreign audiences, I will say this in the name of the Foreign Ministry. The people of Crimea are eager to talk to you directly. Crimea and the city of Sevastopol have a bright future. They are open to those who want to visit these Russian regions and see for themselves what the situation is like. We have had televised communications with foreign journalists for you and your colleagues from Crimea, representatives of NGOs. We organize press tours and trips, and we are ready to organize ad hoc events on your requests. And the most important thing is that no one is willing to embellish the situation there. We all want an objective look at the situation in Crimea and on the lives of the people there. Come there, talk to them, and draw your own conclusions. But do not produce fakes and unverified information. Now, moving on to the situation in Syria, to the regular information provided by the Defense Ministry, we also have our own information to add, in particular on the situation in East Ghouta. In response to the daily shellings of the central districts of Damascus by terrorists who are in East Ghouta, the Syrian army has begun a large-scale offensive in this rural region in order to eliminate the security threat. Russia does not consider this counter-terrorist operation as contradicting the recently adopted Resolution 2401 by the UN Security Council and supports the fight against terrorists in East Ghouta by the actions of East's Air Force. Point 2 of this resolution reaffirms that the cessation of hostilities does not concern the military operations against ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, and other terrorist groups, which are claimed as terrorists by the UN Security Council. In coordination with the Syrian authorities, the Russian military takes all the necessary measures aimed at avoiding victims among the civilian population, which are used as a living shield by the terrorists. We provide them with food and medications through the UN humanitarian convoys. We evacuate the victims and those who have injuries and help those who require medical aid. And on the 5th of March, we have assisted the humanitarian convoy of the UN to the largest town of East Ghouta, the town of Douma. The convoy has delivered food enough to provide living for 27,000 people during a month. While the self-proclaimed representatives of the opposition who are well beyond East Ghouta make their declarations on the supposed preparation of the armed groups in the enclave to comply with the Resolution 2401, the terrorists working on the ground continue to undermine the humanitarian pauses established at the initiative of Russia and carried out by the Syrian military. They continue shelling the humanitarian corridors meant for evacuating the injured and for escaping the population wishing to leave the counter-terrorist operation zone. According to Russia's estimations, the responsibility for the hostilities happening in East Ghouta and the deaths and sufferings of people lies on the terrorists and those field commanders who, instead of using these opportunities that have been opened after the establishment of the de-escalation zones, and instead of complying with the agreements in Cairo in 2017 on the disengagement, simply made an arrangement with al-Nusra, turning into their own weapon. And the criticisms from a number of Western capitals on the supposed indiscriminate strikes by the Syrian army in East Ghouta, once again, as always, have no proof. They are absurd from the point of view of logic, and accusing Damascus of using poisonous substances do not serve the interests of ceasing the hostilities and bloodshed and saving the civilians in the enclave. They only help those who conspired with the terrorists, breeding contempt and hopes that the Syrian government's decisiveness to stop the threat of terrorists can be broken. That is not true. That is a mistake. That's a false evaluation. Their perverted impression of the Resolution 2401 only shows that we should continue uncompromised fight against terrorism and all its manifestation. Their calculations are simply criminal in nature. I would like to draw your attention to the consequences of the operation on conquering Raqqa. The operation was carried out by the US-led coalition, and we are still concerned about the situation in this city. And within our contribution to the Resolution 2401 of the UN Security Council aimed at more active efforts to promote the improvement of humanitarian situation in the whole territory of Syria, Russia has put forth an initiative to create and establish an international evaluation mission which would provide an independent and impartial estimation of the current situation in this large Syrian city. The city, which is the center of the province with the same name, from November 2016 to October 2017, Raqqa, which had up to 1 million people back then, 800,000 to be precise, including 300,000 people of the city population, as well as those who found shelter. I'm talking about the temporarily displaced persons. Raqqa was besieged by the US-led coalition. The people were trapped in this city and they were used by ISIL simply as, I use the comparison, as a living shield, as a human shield. Terrorists did not let them out, and the coalition forces were not concerned about the creation of the humanitarian corridors. Humanitarian aid through the UN or through any other international structures were not performed. The city and all its inhabitants were considered by the occupying forces as the capital of the ISIL caliphate, and the special notion which should be emphasized is that the relations between the ethnic Kurds and Arabs were escalated, and Raqqa was facing bombardments from the air. And when the siege began, the American artillery began its shellings, and most regions of the city were destroyed, razed to the ground, and the aerial frames published on the internet were likely made using a drone. They show an atrocious picture, but that which was destroyed can be rebuilt. But some matters and some questions cannot be answered. For example, how many people are still in Raqqa? What are their life conditions? Who is in power in the city? Who controls the situation in Raqqa? And who does the so-called Council of Raqqa reply to and respond to, and what is it? The access to the city from the regions under the control of the government of Syria is non-existent. Even journalists are not allowed there, simply not allowed to enter. We often hear from our Western colleagues and journalists asking this question. They ask us why we do not cover the situation in certain regions of Syria. They all say that it is dangerous for their lives. This is also an answer. And in this case, they are simply not allowed to come there. Perhaps this is due to the unwillingness of the liberators of Raqqa from ISIS to show the price that was paid by the city's population for their liberation. During the hostilities, collateral damage is always present. Unfortunately, this is a term, coined term, especially during a large-scale military operation to eliminate such a perverted enemy, the international terrorism in the face of ISIL. But we want the military task not to result in the destruction, in the desolation of large regions. We do not want it to doom the population to misery and humiliation by the winners. On the other hand, we should create the conditions for a quick restoration of economic and social infrastructure and to return the temporarily displaced persons and refugees to their homes, in order not to turn the hardship-filled lives of the people into real hell. In our opinion, it would be natural if this process was led by the official authorities, since Syria remains a sovereign state, and the power and responsibility should cover the whole territory of the country, and several more issues which also require an answer. Is anything being done for that in Raqqa? What is the volume of the aid required for the people who remain in the city? The answers should be given by the International Evaluation Mission, and the prospects of its creation were welcomed by the government of Syria.
For this week, we have received a large number of questions from you and from your colleagues abroad. These questions concern new systems of strategic weapons. According to the Foreign commentaries made with regard to the Vladimir Putin state of the nation, we have seen a large number of articles and official statements and statements made by political scientists and other experts. They talk about the Russian new defense system, but unfortunately, these experts ignored the reasons for the development of such strategies. They still ignore the fact that this is a step which should be regarded as a response to actions taken by the United States and NATO allies, who continue to escalate the situation in military and in political situation.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.